This is David Wilner. You're listening to another edition of Landmines, courtesy of Foundation Stone. We're sitting here in the studio with David Wilder. David Wilder is the official spokesperson for the city of Hebron, the city of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. What does that mean, the official spokesperson of Hebron?
What does it mean? It means that I have to swallow a lot of horrible things. Spokes means that there are different levels. I represent the community. I deal with foreign journalists. I deal with groups that come in. Anybody that's interested in knowing anything about Hebron for one reason or another. Again, you have a lot of correspondents that come in. I have a guy from France coming in. I had the other day, I don't even remember where he's from. I try to forget them as fast as I possibly can. But basically working as a spokesperson, and I primarily deal with the English-speaking press or English-speaking public, whatever, be it from Israel or outside of Israel. Noam Arnon deals more with the Israeli-Hebrew side of things. We switch every once in a while, but for the most part, that's the breakup. But actually, I also do a lot of work with photography, stills, video, anything that it takes to get the word out. I do a lot of writing. I have a blog up with 600 and some odd articles that I've written in the last 15 or 16 or 17 years.
So I'm on your list, and I receive your articles periodically, and some of them are really, dvarim hayotzim min alev, things that are spoken from the heart, and they're very, very powerful, and I encourage people, and we'll provide the address of how people can sign up to the blog. How did you get started with this? You obviously were not born here in the land of Israel, right? What's the backstory here?
Well, my story, where do I come from?
How did you get to be doing what you're doing?
Look, in the end, it's all education, and that's really what it is. It's all education, and that's what I wanted to do in Israel. I didn't know that this is where I would be doing it and this is how I would be doing it, but that was my interest when I decided to come to Israel, education. Look, I was born in the United States. I grew up in New Jersey in a very normal, secular, middle-class Jewish family. Went to Sunday school, Hebrew school. For one reason or another, my Jewish identity was embedded into me one way or another, and the idea of Israel primarily came when I was about to have bar mitzvah. And you know what bar mitzvahs are in the States? They're weddings plus. My parents weren't big on parties like that, and they said to me, if you want, rather than have a big party, we'll have a little party, and we'll use the money, invest that in a trip to Israel for a summer. And I didn't care about the parties. I'd gone to my friends' parties, and they didn't do anything to me. So I said, great, sounds like fun. For various reasons, I never made it, but the idea was in my head. When I was in high school, I had a very good friend who was very involved in Israel activities, and he had a brother who was in Israel for a year on a one-year program. So when I went to university, the idea of possibly being able to get out for a year, sophomore year was 73, Yom Kippur War, again, Israel, in the forefront. And I applied to attend Hebrew University for a year on a one-year program and was accepted. And so I spent a year in Yerushalayim. I lived with four other guys in an apartment in the middle of Jerusalem, who for me at that time were all very religious. They all had kippahs on their heads. They were all conservative. Basically was my first exposure to any kind of religious Judaism, which I had no conception of. Why can't you turn on a light on Shabbat? And there I had Shabbat. It was different from the Shabbat that I have today, but it's a whole lot more than I'd ever seen before. And in a very, very slow way, I started to get involved in religious Judaism. That was a process that continued over a number of years. And that year also just turned me upside down, because by the time the year had ended, I realized I was coming back. I hadn't decided to make Aliyah, but I knew I had to come back. I went back, graduated, and instead of going to law school, came back to Israel a month later and basically stayed. At one point, I decided to go to yeshiva for a year. I figured if you want to be religious, you don't know anything. So I spent the next 8 years in yeshiva studying. After I'd been at Machon Meir for a year, Rav Dov Bigon met me up with a woman who we went out for a long time, 9 days, and got engaged and got married 3 months later. And that was in 1979, so we're talking about almost 35 years. We moved to Kiryat Arba in 1981. We wanted to go someplace where we felt we could give something. Back then, of course, we're talking about the granddaddy of all of the pullouts, the first one, Yamit, the Sinai. We realized Judea, Samaria, Gaza were on the list. And we found ourselves in Kiryat Arba, lived there for 17 years. I started working for the Yishuv in Hebron 20 years ago. We moved down there 15 years ago to live there. And basically, I sort of fell into it because I started working, doing administrative. Their office had collapsed. I started doing administrative work, and we started to come into Oslo. And reporters started to come in. There were groups coming in. There was nobody there to speak to them, and I spoke English. And Kadosh Baruch Hu gave me enough sechel to know how to answer questions in a fairly normal way. And Oslo led into the Hebron Accords, and then you had journalists like flies and flies and mosquitoes and whatever you want to call them. And that was also the beginnings of internet. We had some very generous people who helped us open up one of the first websites in Israel. I started working on that. I bought a first generation digital camera. Somebody brought it to me and said, play with it for a few days. And I took it into the office, took a picture of the guys I was working with, put up the picture on the screen and said, come look. And they said, buy it. I would think I was probably one of the first people in the world putting up pictures on the web in real time. Nobody saw them. Nobody knew about it, but they were there. And it's basically developed, in short.
Since then. So you've been there now for more than 5 minutes, and you've seen the ups and downs to a large degree. Hebron's not on people's Jewish radar screen, for the most part, unless you're looking to fight, but in the religious Jewish world, there's almost a, I would call it a virtual Hebron that people think about that has to do with the Avot, the forefathers, and but it's very that there's an actual Hebron that I can connect to, that I can come to, is very much removed from their thinking, and I wasn't gonna talk about this, but I think it's actually a good illustration. You know, in 1980 there was an attack on Beit Hadassah. And I was a student in Yerushalayim at the time, and a friend of mine was learning in Kiryat Arba, and the yeshiva suddenly had 17 guys in the hospital, and 6 guys were killed. And they said, we come and be mechazik the Beit Midrash there. Come and help us strengthen the study hall. And I went down for Shabbat, and I wound up staying for a week, but Friday night we davened in, prayed in, in the Mara, and then we went to Beit Hadassah so that there should be continuity. And I remember Sunday morning, we went again to daven at the Ma'ara, which was not normal at that time to do. And there was no tsar. There was a closure from the army around Hebron. People were not going in and out freely. And they cut away barbed wire from between Kiryat Arba and Hebron so that we could get in. And I went with friends in the army, some chayalim, some soldiers, on a jeep. I went with a group of these guys to the apartment that was overlooking the front of Beit Hadassah. The apartment belonged to a doctor who later ran away to Jordan, but the apartment had been used by the Arab terrorists as the staging ground for the attack on the front of Beit Hadassah. And one of the chayalim that I was with, he took out a penknife as we walked into the apartment, we walked up the stairs, and he scraped away the paint on the doorpost, and there was a mezuzah intact that had been painted over, which was not an unusual thing, because this was a Jewish neighborhood 30 years earlier. We have conceptually abandoned our own narrative. And I think it's tragic. And we talk about narratives all the time, and everybody's got a narrative. You've got your narrative, and the Arabs have their narrative. And it's almost nonsensical, because there are empirical truths. I believe, and maybe I'm wrong, and it's very politically non-correct for me to talk this way, but I don't want this to be political, because I really want to get to the historical on all of this. But there is damage that's being done to the Jewish connection to the land of Israel. And we've been so much focused on empowering others that we've forgotten to empower ourselves. And so people don't know that there is a recent Jewish history in Hebron, which to a large degree was probably dealt a critical blow after the Arab riots in the 1920s and the 1930s. And to a large degree at that point in time, we kind of emotionally disengaged as a people from Hebron. But for hundreds and hundreds of years before that, Jewish life in Hebron was regular, it was normal. And I told people that when I was a kid, you know, and I would see and watch my grandfather, Lev Shalom, you know, he would sign checks for this yeshiva and that yeshiva, and he would get from Israel. And he would always get a calendar from the institution, and there was a picture of Marat HaMachpelah, and there was a picture of Hebron, because that was, and Jerusalem, obviously, those were the symbols of Jewish life going back for millennia of Jews in Israel. And now, if we say we have a connection to Hebron, you must be a right-wing extremist. And I think that we have allowed ourselves to be steered into a corner on that, so that the perception is that if you have a connection to Hebron, you must be a right-wing extremist. And I think that largely buys into the narrative of other people, not our own narrative. So what I'd like to do in the time that we have, right, is to try to recraft or reshape or reframe the Jewish narrative and the Jewish connection to Hebron together with you. So let's start at the beginning, okay? All right, and when I'm talking about the beginning, where do the Jewish roots in Hebron begin?
Well, again, it depends how far back you want to go. Look, what they call in Hebrew the Nigla side, the revealed side, okay, is Abraham. Okay, Abraham, the first Jew, settling in Hebron. It's basically the first Jewish city in Israel. That's where it's written in the Bible that he settled. You know, he came to Hebron. He came from up north. He went through Shechem. He went through Beit El. He stopped at all of these places, said hello to everybody, but he stopped in Hebron, and he lived in Hebron. He split most of the rest of his life between Hebron and Beersheba. But according, now that's, as we say, the revealed side that you can read about in the Bible. There's a more esoteric side, which begins before Abraham, back with the days of Adam and Eve. And the stories that are brought down, not only in what you would call Midrashim, you can define that as however, but in the Zohar Kadosh, the most esoteric books that we have in Judaism, tell us very clearly that the beginnings of Hebron, if we talk about the cave of Machpelah, goes back to the beginnings of the creation, okay, where it's written that after Adam Rishon, the first man, and his wife Chava Eve were exiled from the Garden of Eden, they wanted to go back. It's nice there, you know, they liked it. They had a problem, though, they didn't know where it was. So it's written that they searched until they came to a point where they could smell the unique fragrances of the Garden of Eden. And there it's written that the first man dug a cave within a cave until a voice from the heavens told him, that's it, that's as far as he can go. And it's written that that's where he buried his wife Eve, that's where he was later buried, and that site remained hidden. Abraham later discovers this site, and he too could smell those unique fragrances of the Garden of Eden. He saw the candles at the tombs of Adam and Eve, candles which revealed a very, very inner light. And he realized how important the site was, how holy the site was, how significant it was. We're talking about the entrance to paradise. We're talking about the entrance to Gan Eden, to the Garden of Eden. And as such, he later purchased that site from the Hittite for 400 silver shekels, which has today been valued at about $700,000. It was a huge amount of money for a cave, for a field. He paid that money. It's written about in extraordinary detail and length in the Bible. And that's those are the beginnings of Hebron. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Bechaleah all lived there, and we can jump further if we want to one of the other greater stages of Jewish history, whereby after Saul was killed in a war with the Philistines, David was told by God specifically to go to Hebron. He said, "Where should I go in the cities of Judea?" And God said, "Hebron, go to Hebron," and David began there the kingdom of Judea. So when we talk about the roots of Judaism, the roots of monotheism, I call it the roots of humanity. It's the beginning of the end of human sacrifice. It's the beginning of the end of bowing down to idols. It's the beginning of a belief in one God and worshiping only that one God begins in Hebron. And the kingdom of David, when we say David Melech, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, David the king of Israel is alive, this all begins in Hebron. The roots of our essence begin in Hebron.
Okay, so we're talking about Hebron in terms of the beginning of the monarchy, the united monarchy of Israel. We have an earlier story, by the way, just to add to what you've said about Joshua sending the spies and Kalev coming to Hebron. When we're talking about Hebron in terms of its influence at the time that David comes there, before he comes there, at these early stages, after the Jews have come into Israel, what does he see in Hebron? What's built up there? Who's there?
What does David find in Hebron? That's a good question. Look, we know today, up until there are things that are written, but in terms there were many people that really didn't believe that, you know, you had a civilized city there even before Abraham. When David comes into Hebron, he probably finds Canaanites, you know.
There's a walled city that's there predates him.
You have walls in Hebron that have been uncovered today in the archaeological excavations that were done both in the 1960s and the end of the 20th century. In 1999, you have a wall that goes back to Middle Bronze, you know, about 3,700 years, the days of Abraham. You have a wall that goes back earlier than that, to Early Bronze. When that was discovered, the archaeologists were amazed because this disproved what people were trying to disprove or negate the importance of Hebron as a city. It's written that Hebron was, you know, was built 7 years before some of the, you know, major cities in Egypt. You're going back, you know, 5,000 years, but there's a wall from early bronze, the days of Noah, on a biblical timeline, and some of these walls probably still existed during the days of King David. He built probably the original city of David, we believe, on the highest point in what is today called Tel Hebron, because the excavations that have been done up through now, there's been very little found from the Davidic era, i.e. 3,000 years ago. What exactly David found in Hebron, I don't know, but it certainly was not, at that point, the Davidic influence in Hebron started to give it the essence that had began back in the days of the patriarchs and the matriarchs.
First of all, the name itself is very revealing about what Hebron is.
Oh, Hebron.
Maybe talk a little bit about what the name Hebron means.
Look, Hebron has different meanings. The Arabs call Hebron al-Khalil,
the friend.
The word in Hebron...
After Abraham.
Yeah, because Abraham was the friend. But there are several different meanings that are very major to understanding Hebron. The word Hebron means chaver, friend, but it also comes from the same word as chibur. Chibur is a bond. It joins together. And many people say, so what does it join together? And there are numerous explanations. If we speak about the cave of Machpelah as the point between this world and the next world, between this world and the Garden of Eden. It's written that people's souls, when they leave their bodies on their way to the next world, go through the caves of Machpelah. It's a very spiritual place. So you're joining together this world and the next world. We're also joining together. Hebron is located in a very, very, very important, significant place in Israel. Basically, it acts as a crossroads from east to west, from north to south, whether you're going from Egypt up to the area of Lebanon and Syria, or you're going from east to west from the Mediterranean, where ships used to come in, and going east towards Jordan, what's today Jordan, and past that. So it's joining together. It's a very central location. It's like a crossroads in the Middle East. But we're also joining together. Hebron, it's written in the Bible, was a city of refuge. It was a city where people who were convicted of unintentionally killing somebody else, it was one of those few cities where people could go and remain, rather than remaining in a prison cell. They had to go to one of a number of different cities, and Hebron was a city of refuge where these people would have to remain, sometimes for many, many years. And as such, it was a place where they had to relearn. They had to be re-educated. They had to try to reach levels where if a person kills somebody else, even if it's unintentionally, that person has a problem, an ethical problem, or a spiritual problem where they would have to go and learn. And this brings together all kinds of different people for one purpose, to learn, to come closer to God, to make them better people, and thereby to make Israel a better people, not individually, but generally speaking, Klal Yisrael. And Hebron integrates all of these elements together, and brings forth a very, very important spiritual place in Israel.
So why is Hebron such a problem then? In other words, if Hebron is so central to our evolving and our early development as a nation, why is it such a problem today?
Look, just for basic background and understanding, trying to reach today, Hebron, was part of the conquests that continued over periods of 2,000s of years. You had in Hebron, if we go back, you can go back to the days of the advent of Christianity 2,000 years ago, where the building on top of the caves of Machpelah, which had been built by Herod 2,000 years ago, that building was taken over by early Christianity and turned into a basilica. They built inside the original Herodian structure a church. The early Muslims came in the middle 600s, and they turned that church into a mosque. The Crusaders came in 1100, and they threw out everybody in the city, all of the Jews. They killed the Muslims, and they threw out the Jews, and they turned the building again back into a church. They built a fortress outside the building. The Mamelukes came in 1260, threw out the Crusaders, and turned it back into a mosque. I don't know that it had tremendous significance to them and tremendous importance, except that they didn't want Jews there. But throughout Muslim history, which is very dominant, predominant in the areas that we're talking about, you don't find mentions of the importance of the site and people, flowing there and praying there. There's even a Muslim scholar who wrote, I believe, in the 1300s, that it's forbidden for Muslims to pray there as it's a cemetery. But that, I guess, that opinion wasn't accepted in the Muslim world. But it was never considered to be a place of tremendous significance. But there were always Jews there. And we know that from accounts that we have in writing going back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. I'm talking about 700, 800, 900 years ago, where even Christian pilgrims and Jews who traveled around the world found Jewish communities. Sometimes they were larger, sometimes they were smaller. The central community that we can speak of coming into the modern era came over in the middle of the 1500s. Jews who had been exiled from Spain in 1492, gone to Turkey, bought a piece of land in Hebron and moved in 1540. The Ashkenazi community, that was a Sephardi community. The Ashkenazi community came in a little bit later. There were always Jews there, with almost no exceptions. But there were, if we come through the middle of the 1500s, the Ottoman conquest, it was all run by Arabs, by sheikhs, muftis, whomever had power in the area. And their relationship with the Jews fluctuated, depending on economics, on politics, on religion. And the relations weren't great, but that's the way they had to live. We also know that coming into the beginning of the 20th century, there were normal, positive relations between Jews and Arabs. Arabs who spoke Yiddish, Ladino, Jews who spoke Arabic, and they lived together.
Like in the old city.
But that started to change abruptly with the advent of beginnings of the return of the Jewish people to Eretz Yisrael. That began, late 1800s, coming into the 1900s, the Arabs saw us coming back. This idea of pan-Arabism, the nationalism coming back to them also, and you had people that hated Jews. They didn't need any reason to hate Jews. You know, you had people like Haji Amin al-Husseini, who was, if you will, Arafat's predecessor. Yeah. He called Arafat his successor. He met with Hitler in Berlin in 1941. He incited against the Jews. There have been books that have been written about him and his connection to Nazi Germany. They detail, I've read some of them, they detail it better than I do, but he hated the Jews. He hated the Jews, number one, just as out of pure hate, but he also realized the Jews were coming back to Israel, and this scared him. And they started to work to try to prevent that. And one of his primary stations was this city, which was of such tremendous importance to the Jews, where Jews were coming back. We remember that in 1924, 1925, there was an influx of Jews into Hebron from Slobodka, Lithuania, where they opened up the Hebron Yeshiva, Yeshivat Knesset Yisrael. And he saw this and incited against the Jews to try to prevent this repopulation of the city by Jews. And that led to a horrible massacre in August of 1929. Now, it's got to be remembered. You have to remember that the Jews at this point thought that they could continue to live with the Arabs. There were people that came to Hebron 2 days before the massacre actually took place, who brought weapons with them from the Haganah or for the Jews' protection, saying the Mufti is inciting, and we can protect you, we can leave you weapons so you can protect yourselves. And the Jews in Hebron said no. They said, we don't need these weapons. The Arabs are our friends. They protected us in 1920. They protected us in 1921. We've already met with them now. Weapons will only act as a provocation. One of the people that came in was Rachel Yanait, who later married Yitzhak Ben Zvi. The Jews in Hebron refused any type of protection. They said they didn't need it. And as a result of that, they were left defenseless. And when the Mufti spread rumors that the Jews were trying to conquer Temple Mount, that Arab blood was flowing through the streets of Yerushalayim, as a signal, and the riots commenced, the Jews in Hebron had no way to protect themselves, and they were slaughtered, literally slaughtered. And basically that brought about the first time the Jews had not been in the city in almost 1,000 years. 3 days after the riots, and 67 people were killed, another 70 were wounded. 3 days later, the survivors were expelled. I knew a man who whose family had been saved. There were Arabs that saved Jews. There weren't enough, but there were those that saved Jews. I knew a man whose family had been saved, and he told me that his father wrote to the British High Commissioner asking why the victims had been punished. Why did they expel the Jews? And the answer he received was, well, everybody thinks I'm an anti-Semite. That's not anti-Semite. That's not true. The reason is because you couldn't continue to live together with them. There were more of them than there were of you. It was easier to expel you than to expel them. And that original expulsion lasted for 3 years. A small group came back in 31. They stayed until the spring of 1936. One night, I believe it was just before Passover in 1936, one of the rabbis, together with the British, went house to house with people that were there, 25, 30 families, saying they're inciting, we can't protect you. They took them as is in the middle of the night and expelled them. And that was the end of a Jewish community until we went back in 1967.
Which is a little bit ironic, because as the story goes, Hebron fell in 1967 to Tzahal, to the Israeli army, without a shot being fired.
That's true. That's true. The story of how he came back to Hebron is is there are a number of different versions. We've been uncovering more and more of them, but the official account that I heard the last time Rabbi Goren was in Hebron before he passed away, where he left Yerushalayim, made his way to Gush Etzion, which had also been liberated the same day on Kafchet Iyar. And he said to the army, when you go to Hebron, I'm going with you. Jews haven't been in Marat Machpelah for 700 years. And he said, when you leave, wake me up. And when he woke up, there was nobody there. He said, they left. They didn't want to take us. He woke up his driver, and they drove by themselves into Hebron. Now today, when you come to Hebron, where, you know, we're in Efrat, you come to Hebron, you go on bypass roads. To then there was no bypass road. You know, you're going straight through the, you know, the city, the villages, and Rav Goren realized they were surrendering. Nobody was shooting at them. They came into Hebron, they saw white sheets hanging from the rooftops, and they realized they were surrendering. They remembered what they'd done to us in 1929, and they were afraid we were going to pay them back. Now, the truth is that I've heard a number of times from different sources in different times, and that's why I think it's true, that there had been orders given that if one shot was fired in Hebron, the army was to decimate the population in retribution for what did happen in Tarpat 1929. That was leaked. That was leaked to the Arabs. The men fled the city. The women hung the sheets outside. There were soldiers who reportedly shot in the air, trying as a provocation somebody might return fire. It didn't happen. When David Ben-Gurion came into Hebron shortly after its liberation, he put his hands up to his ears and said, you know, what's these sheep that I hear around us? You know, referring back to what Shmuel had said to Shaul HaMelech, you know, like, why are they still here? You know, like, you know, and, but we came back in 1967 during the Six-Day War. People started to move back in Hebron. But again, I think it's imperative to understand that what's happening today started then. It even happened before the Six-Day War, because the Israeli government, as the war began, sent representatives, including Golda Meir, to Hussein in Jordan to plead with him not to enter the war. And his reaction to that, they said, we don't want anything. And we're talking about a time when Yerushalayim was divided. We had no access to Har HaBayit. We had no access to the wall. And the Israeli government at that time was already giving that to them. They were conceding that to them, saying, we don't want anything, just stay out of it. Talking about a war with Egypt and Syria on two fronts. We didn't need a third front. And Hussein, his reaction to that was to start to shell Jerusalem. He started shooting into Israel, and at that point we had no choice. It was thrust upon us. The Israeli army went into Yerushalayim. It went into all of Yehuda v'Shomron, coming down through Hebron. They didn't have to fight. It was all open. The Arabs were petrified. We came into Hebron with Rav Goren coming into Hebron, literally. Nobody stood in his path. He drove into the city itself, and there he finds he's able to enter Marat Machpelah, and there was nobody stopping. As a matter of fact, the Mufti of Hebron sent a messenger to him saying that he wanted to come surrender, and he sent him away saying, "This is a place of prayer and peace. Go surrender someplace else," which he did. He later told us the real reason he didn't accept the surrender. He said, "I'm a general. I'm going to give them the honor to surrender to a general. They should surrender to a low-ranking officer," which they also did. But the, I think perhaps one of the most telling parts of the story, which I normally today with tourists don't tell, depending on who they are, but there was a continuation of the story, because Rav Goren came into Marat Machpelah. He brought in a Sefer Torah, and he hung an Israeli flag outside. And that night he received a telegram from the defense minister, Moshe Dayan, who hadn't wanted Hebron in the first place, and said, take down the flag, take out the Sefer Torah, and anybody goes in has to take their shoes off because it's a mosque. Rav Goren sent him a telegram back saying, the Sefer Torah is holy, it stays. The flag means to me what it means to you. You want to, you take it down. I'm not going to touch it. And Dayan sent an officer into Hebron to take the flag down. This poor man did what he was told to do, and on his way back to his army base was killed in an automobile accident. And with that, Dayan rescinded the order saying, you have to take your shoes off. That's why today we don't have to take our shoes off. But this is how we come back to Hebron. You deal with the old city. When residents from the old city of Jerusalem who had been expelled during the war in 1948 went to Dayan and said, we want to go back home. give us our property back, let us rebuild, let us reestablish the Jewish quarter, he accepted that. When residents from Hebron, who had been expelled after the riots in 1929, 1936, went back, he wouldn't talk to them. He wouldn't open his door. He wouldn't meet with them. In other words, Hebron wasn't considered to be a Jewish city. It wasn't considered to be an Israeli city. They considered it to be a card that they could use when they were negotiating for whatever concessions, whatever would be done afterwards.
So let me ask you a question. We signed an agreement on Hebron. Is there more peace in Hebron? Is the situation with the Arabs better now, or is it worse?
We signed a peace agreement, PIECE. You know, we give them one piece and another piece and another piece. Look, life wasn't rosy before Oslo, and life wasn't rosy before the Hebron Accords. But we tend to say that the real issues began with the beginning of peace. Okay, the Hebron Accords were signed as we're speaking. We're speaking on January 21st. Yesterday was 17 years since the Hebron Accords were signed, splitting the city. Most of the city was abandoned to Yasser Arafat. Israeli troops pulled out of the city, pulled out of the what turned into the Arab side of the city, the Palestinian Authority-controlled side of the city. Immediately, massive rocket and firebomb attacks started to take place from what was then turned into a border. I remember where I today live. I wasn't living then in Hebron. I was working there, and you could almost set your clock knowing exactly what time it was going to start and exactly when it was going to finish. It was all planned. And around where I'm living today, Beit Hadassah, there were huge rock attacks. People couldn't go outside. And basically the Arabs expected that they were going to receive the whole city. It was just a question of time until we either picked up and left, were expelled, or were massacred, and, you know, so that there weren't going to remain there any Jews. This continued into the Second Intifada. Part of what was transferred to Arafat then were the hills that surround us. We are basically in a valley, excepting Tel Rumeida, which is the highest point, which is also beneath the hills that surround us on almost all sides. And these were given to Arafat, and the Arabs started to shoot at us. The beginning of the Second Intifada, what we call the Oslo War, the end of one or two days before Rosh Hashanah in the year 2000, they started to shoot at us from those hills, and that shooting continued for almost 2.5 years. So we saw murder and injuries and very difficult events for that.
I just want to point out that when you say shoot at us, meant indiscriminate shooting.
Well, of course, indiscriminate shooting. We're talking about
shooting. Not an army facing off against an army.
No. They're shooting into our homes.
And maybe talk about Shalhevet Pass.
Look, even before Shalhevet, just as personal examples, my home in Beit Hadassah, all of my windows faced the hills. We put sandbags in all the windows. And there were places where I left a little space, you know, for a little light here and there. And a sniper picked up one of the spaces, and he shot into my home, and he missed two of my kids by literally a couple of inches, mamish, without exaggerating. The story of Shalhevet didn't have to happen. The day that she was killed, I had picked up a friend of mine from the airport, and I arrived back in the Avraham Avinu neighborhood, I guess at about 4:10, 4:15. Parked the car, and as I opened the door, there was a gunshot. Now, there was a lot of shooting. The shooting had already begun, but I felt it. Okay, the bullet wasn't too far from where I was, and there was a soldier there, and I said, they just took a shot at me, and he said, no, it was a firecracker. They used to blow up a lot of firecrackers and try to confuse everybody. I said, it was a bullet. I know what a bullet is. It was a gunshot. And he said, no, it was a firecracker. And with that, I went inside. And a few minutes later, my daughter and one of my sons, who were sitting outside, not too far from where I was, my daughter came running into the office hysterical that the baby had been shot and that Itzik had been shot. And I went outside and found the baby with a hole in her head, trying to do something for her. At that point, there was nothing they could do for her. And Itzik Pass, her father, lying on the ground, sort of trying to see what was going on with the medics treating him. He had a bullet that had gone through two of his legs. Now, I later discovered that that the first shot that I had heard, there was a woman standing not too far from me with a 2 or 2.5 year old child. The child started to complain that her hand hurt, and they thought that she had skinned it on something. And that night, when she kept complaining, they took a good look at it, and the whole side of her hand was burned. That was that bullet, that first bullet. There were kids inside the neighborhood with, there was a child with a sweater who had 2 holes in the sweater, you know, in and out, and it didn't hit the baby, that the child was playing there. If the soldier, when I had originally spoken to him, had taken action and they'd started to shoot back, then you know, Shalhevet never would have been killed. It would have stopped right then. And that's always disturbed me very much. I have a photograph that I took of her a few weeks earlier in Purim, with her mother, with a teddy bear. And when I realized, I didn't know her name when I took the picture, when I realized that was Shalhevet, you know, it was devastating. But this went on. People, and I saw there were, I can't begin to count the miracles, whether it was in my house. I saw with my own 2 eyes a woman bend down to take a baby out of the car, and a bullet went over her. You know, went, if she hadn't bent down, she would have been killed. The bullet would have hit her in her head or in her chest. And she bent down to take a baby out of the car, and the bullet missed her. And that happened more than once. I can't begin to count the miracles. If there hadn't been miracles, then people would have been killed there every day.
So what does the future look like in Hebron?
After that?
Yeah, after that. Because, the reality is you're not going anywhere.
Listen.
You're in this for the long haul.
The reality is like this. The reality is that... you know, I use 2 stories that I use as examples to explain how we keep going in Hebron and where our head's at. And I think this is very representative. It's not just me. I once met some journalists on what's called Hebron Liberation Day, the day after Yom Yerushalayim, Yom Hebron, Kaf Tet Iyar. And they set up their cameras and started pumping me with questions, and we had all sorts of problems, and they asked me at all these different issues. And when we were finished, they said to me, well, guess you're not celebrating today. I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, you have all these problems. I said, you don't understand it. I said, where was I 70 years ago? Where was I 50 years ago? Today I'm in Hebron. You're right, we have issues. We've had issues for the last 2,000 years. We had to overcome them. But if we were able to overcome 2,000 years, if we were able to overcome a Shoah, a Holocaust, where somewhere between 6 to 7 million Jews were slaughtered, we can overcome the problems we have. As long as I'm here, I have what to celebrate. But it's deeper than that. So I tell people a story of the guy who was in Auschwitz, 1944, standing behind the fire, the barbed wire, watching the smoke come out of the chimneys, and somebody comes and pokes him on the shoulder and says, hey guy, cheer up. In another 4 years, we're going to have a state, and we're going to have a war, and we're going to beat everybody. We're going to win. And the other one looks at him and he says, buddy, you flipped out. There's no way out. The smoke. That's it. There's no other way out. That's what there is. And he was right. But he was wrong. Because four years later, we had a state. And we were attacked by all the Arab countries that surround us. And we were victorious. In other words, I can only see as far as my nose. I can look at you. I can look out the window. But I can't see any further than that. But there's a plan. Okay? And I don't necessarily know what it is. But there's a God above, and he's basically, you know, conducting the world. And just because I can't see it doesn't mean it's not going to happen. So we have to do what we can do. We have to do our part, and we have to leave a little bit for him too. And that's what we try to do. We do our part. We're not always successful in everything that we do, but we have to try. Because, you know, people ask me why we're in Hebron. And there are many, many reasons for that. One of them is very clear. For 700 years, the Tomb of the Patriarchs, the second holiest site the Jewish people in the world, was off limits to anybody who was not Muslim. And our neighbors tell us today that if they ever control it again, they won't let us in. They mean what they say.
They make no secret about it.
And we're today talking about between 700,000 to 800,000 people a year that visit that site. And it doesn't stand to reason that in the 21st century, anybody who wants to pray in a holy place can't pray there.
Do you know if the people who are coming to Hebron, what percentage are coming from our visitors to Israel, and what's local tourism from the Jewish world like?
Look, that's one of the major issues that we have, and that's one of the major things that we're trying to deal with. We have huge tourism from outside of Israel. We have a very, very large tourism of Jews from the United States, from Europe. I think that you began by talking about how Hebron is off of the radar. It's coming back. Today people are aware. People know what's going on in Hebron. We've been around the United States. People hear, they see. Not everybody.
Do secular Jews come from outside the country?
Yeah, we get secular Jews also, but again, you look at the statistics of tourist statistics, who's coming here, who's coming to live in Israel. Okay, you get a larger religious population coming over than non-religious, but you get a lot of non-Jews. You get a lot of Christians that come over from all over the world. We get people from England who have come over, English Christian groups that have come over and apologized for the acts of the British government in the 1920s and the 1930s in Hebron and their policies throughout Israel at that time through pre-state Israel. You have people that come over from the Philippines, from Korea, you name it, people come over. And I get journalists more. I say, what do you care about? You know, you've got your own problems in China, you know, what do you care? But they do care. Because just as Israel plays a much larger role in the world media than its size, so too Hebron. People hear about it. But we're trying very hard to bring in more Israelis. Sometimes it's more difficult to bring in an Israeli than it is to bring in an American from Kansas. Or for the evangelicals, a woman from Kiryat Gat said to me, but how can I get to Hebron? I mean, Kiryat Gat is 45 minutes from Hebron, right? How can I get there? You know, or a guy, I met a guy who was 45, 50 years old, who grew up in Nes Ziona. He'd never been to Hebron before. He was a driver, I think, for somebody who came in, and he was so emotional. He was going into Ma'at Machpelah for the first time. I said, why haven't you ever come? I people hear. There's this kind of when do you hear about a place? Okay, how often is Efrat in the news? Efrat isn't in the news. The only time Efrat will be in the news is if, God forbid, something happens here. Okay, somebody gets shot, lo aleinu. So all of a sudden it's in the news. When people only hear about a place whenever something negative happens there, then that leaves an impression that that's the way it is all the time. And they pick up things in the media, and they read lies and media accounts. I've had people that come into Hebron and, you know, thought that there were no women in Hebron. They were told there was only men, and when no women and children, it was cowboys and Indians all day. And when they come in and they see women and they see children, and we've had that with Israeli media, you know, that didn't even do the stories. They didn't publish or write or show the videos because it didn't play into their agenda. It looked too good. It's very, very important today to get more people in, whether they be from the States or from Israel, so they see what it really is. And I hear it time and time again. We were up in Tel Rameda. We went up to Kevarut Vishai, the tomb of Jesse and Ruth, years and years and years ago, like back when I was just beginning to work in Hebron. I once had a couple of Israeli guys who had served in the army in Hebron. And they brought in a 19 or 20-year-old girl they were with. And I'll never forget, as we were leaving, they were walking behind me, and she said to them in Hebrew, but this isn't what they taught us. This isn't what they told us. This isn't what they showed us. And she was in shock. And that hasn't changed. And you still see it and hear it today. And that's why we make a tremendous effort to bring in Knesset members, to bring in ministers, people that have never been in Hebron, or people that hadn't been in Hebron in 30 years. And they see the people and they talk with us. Their ideology doesn't change overnight. But they realize that it's not what they read about in Haaretz or in Ma'ariv. It's something else that has to be dealt with. And we've had people that have come in and said, I have problems with the people here, but you can't abandon Hebron. You know, there was Noam was with a group once. They were in the Jacob Hall in Ma'at Machpelah, and one of the men stood up. It was a group of reservists, and he got up and he said, you know, I'm a secular Jew, and a few years ago, somebody asked me, am I first a Jew or first an Israeli? And I really didn't know how to answer the question. And he said, after I've been in Hebron, and after I've been in Ma'at Machpelah, I know now that you cannot be an Israeli without being a Jew. And that says it all.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that we found was that it's actually a story about Aryeh Eldad, who went on a tour of Harival, of Mount Ebal, in the north, and it had been under closure for many, many years. And he went with the army, who escorted him as a chaver Knesset, as a member of the Knesset. There was a military escort, and they opened opened the site up for them. And he said to the soldier that was walking next to him as they were walking, what do you think about when you come to a place like this? And he said, what do you mean? And he said, well, are you moved in any way? He says, I don't know anything about this place. He goes, the army, you're sitting here, you're protecting the place, you're in this location. He goes, no one's ever explained this place to me. He goes, well, what about when you visit other places of Jewish history?
Anything about them.
And he said, I don't know. We sat on the back of the bus. We had our headphones on. We didn't really pay attention. So did you do that when you went to Masada also? I don't know if I've ever been to Masada.
This is very normal.
We have a problem.
Listen, I remember when I was moving into my home in Beit Hadassah, we're driving down the street, and at one of the corners, a soldier stopped me. Ah, good boy, I stopped. And, you know, Shalom, what do you want? And he looked at his hand. He picked up his hand, and he said, tell me, is it true that in that building over there is Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov? You know, like when I was coming down from the excavations, we were up there on Friday, I guess. A couple of mornings ago, I was up there. And as I came down, there was a soldier up there, guarding near there. And I said, do you know where you are? And I started to tell him about the excavations below that have already been uncovered and tell him what they're going to find up above. And it's so important that they know where they are. I said, you know, you have a schut, you have such a privilege. You're in a uniform where Abraham lived, where King David lived, and we're uncovering it. You can see it with your own eyes. We do a lot of work with the army. A number of years ago, I think it may have been when Raful was the Ramatkal, the head of the army, were after him, realizing the importance of Hebron to that. Forget the religious side, the heritage of the Jewish people, the tradition of the Jewish people, the heritage of the Jewish people, that it was important that the people in the army, they take them different places, and they come to Hebron. And they come not for any kind of a political spiel, they come for history. And they see the places and they hear about it. And many of these guys, the first time they've ever been here, you know, they never crossed the Green Line till they were in the army. You know, it was considered all to be Judea-Samaria, it's all off limits. And we do a lot of work with them in that way so that they should at least know, okay? You always want to persuade people politically, but even if they don't agree with everything that you do and you say, they should at least know what we're talking about. If they say we have to abandon Hebron in the name of peace, they should know what they're talking about. What is it? And take it from there. And you're right. The fact that these people, the education is very lacking. And that's probably the Israeli school system, the Israeli education system.
You know, I'll tell you, I was the gabbai in the synagogue nearby where I live. And when they were signing the Hebron agreement, and every week I would put up the luach, the schedule of times for the different prayers and things like that. And that week I wrote at the bottom of the page, Al Hebron Dava Libenu, which means, over Hebron, our hearts are aggrieved. Because I didn't want the week to pass without people understanding that we were giving something away that was precious and dear to us and significant to us. And I was shocked. Before Shabbat, I assume, someone came in and tore off the bottom of the page. One of my neighbors, who prays with me, came and tore that off the bottom of the page. And later on, he came over to me and he said, are you trying to undermine peace? And I said, it has nothing to do with undermining peace or not. I said, understand that this is something that people need to appreciate, that what's being done, whether it's for legitimate reasons or illegitimate reasons, is giving something that is part of our legacy, our national heritage. And so maybe the intention is good. I don't personally agree with it, but we should feel it. We should know that what's going on is something that is he couldn't get his head around that. He couldn't, there was something I was doing to undermine peace in his mind. we have an opportunity. And, you know, we hear on the news all the time, really all the time, this is our last chance for peace, and if we don't do something crazy and outrageous now, there'll never be another opportunity like this again tomorrow. And one thing we know is that what was here yesterday was, but we can do tremendous damage in the meantime. And you occupy a very unique chair. And the chair that you're sitting in is there as a resource for people to discover more, to learn more, to find out more. And wherever you're listening to this broadcast, wherever you're listening to this recording, go on the Hebron website. You'll give that address, please.
Look, the website right now, we're on the verge, Bezrat Hashem, with God's help, of renovating. So it's not really updated all the time.
So then give your email address.
First of all, the website is hebron.com. Very easy, okay. hebron.com. People can reach me. My Hebron email is hebron@hebron.com, hebron@hebron.com. I do a lot of writing, and people can keep up to date. The blog appears in the Jerusalem Post, in Arutz Sheva, Israel National News. I have my own site. If people want to go into what I have, I think it's davidwilder.org. I have up where we have, I have apps for Android phones that people can pick off. People can go into my major blog with everything that I've ever written there, and keep updated. And people can feel free to be in touch with us. People are interested coming to Israel and want to take a tour. We have fabulous tours. Person who leads most of the tours is Rabbi Simcha Hochbaum, who has today an international reputation, not only as a teacher and a Rebbe, but also as a tour guide. The tours from Jerusalem to Kever Rachel, Rachel's tomb, into Hebron, back to Jerusalem. They're not very expensive, and they
every Friday there's a tour
The tours that we lead are during the winter are initiated every Wednesdays, and during the summer, two or three times a week. People can go into the Hebron Fund. There's a Hebron Fund website, hebronfund.org. I think it's hebronfund.org or hebronfund.com, one of the two of them. And you can actually register for the tours online. And they're highly recommended. People have a really good time. They really enjoy them. They leave on a high. They see, they hear, they feel. It's a boost for them. It's a boost for us. And I always tell people when they've come into Hebron, they leave as ambassadors. They have to take back to all of those people that you yourself mentioned don't come or haven't been in years. They can take what they've learned and what they've experienced back to others and pass the word. That's what I do. You know, that's what I spend my life doing. But others can take that, and whether it's people in their synagogues or in their churches or in their wherever they are, and pass on the word that not everything that you hear is true. If you really want to understand it, go see it, and then let's talk after.
I'll end with one final story, and that is I have four sons, and my two oldest sons, we took them, the relatives came, you know, for their bar mitzvahs, we took them, and they read the Torah at the Kotel, and it was very nice, very difficult logistically. Now it's even more difficult logistically getting in and out of the old city. And with my third son, I didn't want to have to deal with that mess. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to have him read the Torah. I'm going to do it in Marat HaMachpelah, in the cave of the patriarchs. And I felt it would be more intimate, and it would be a little more Hamish, you know, a little bit more human, rather than the whole scene that goes on in the old city. And we did that. We came, it was in February 3 years ago. And it was fabulous. He had such a good time. And there was such a personal connection to what he was doing, and the fact that the family could be more intimately involved with what was going on. And there, it wasn't, you know, this carnival kind of a thing that goes on at the Kotel. So I want to suggest for all those people who haven't considered making a bar mitzvah, right, in Hebron, if you're thinking about doing a bar mitzvah here in Israel, and I highly recommend it, consider look into the possibility, and that's something you can speak to the people in Hebron about as well.
We do that. We do run bar mitzvahs, and not only can a person come in, I mean, you know, you live 20 minutes from Hebron, but people that come in, we give bar mitzvah tours, and we can set up a breakfast, you know, so people, you know, they don't have to fast on the day of a bar mitzvah. And it's very special, because when a child begins his life as a new person, when he's reborn, when he takes upon himself the Torah, the mitzvot, or even if he's not religious, he's just celebrating to begin where we began, to begin with Abraham, is very, very special. And I don't know if there's anything like it. We have weddings in Hebron. So first we do the bris, then we have the bar mitzvah, and then they get married there.
From cradle to grave. David Wilder, I want to thank you for coming in. It was very special having you here, and I urge the listeners to please be in touch with the Hebron Jewish community and to consider the possibilities of what you can do to help this important site in Jewish history.
Thanks. Thank you.